How far will a state go to improve its economy? In Kentucky, plans are underway for a religious theme park. Critics argue the state shouldn't be giving tax breaks for religious purposes, but as Sherry Lawson of member station WNKU reports, the project has the backing of a governor who's eager to create jobs.
The park centerpiece will be a replica of Noah's Ark, a wooden boat longer than a football field. Other attractions include a first-century Middle Eastern village, a Tower of Babel, and a walled city. When Democratic Governor Steve Beshear announced Kentucky's support last December for the Ark Encounter, he touted the economic impact.
This is a $150 million investment that is projected to create nearly 900 jobs, including almost 550 full-time jobs.
Private investors and a Christian ministry called Answers in Genesis plan to build the park in northern Kentucky's Grant County, south of Cincinnati. In 2007, the nonprofit opened the Creation Museum in nearby Petersburg. Exhibits teach the Earth is 6,000 years old and created in six 24-hour days. Even though many have mocked the museum, founder Ken Ham says more than a million people have visited, 80% from out of state.
As people have come through the various exhibits, a number have often asked us about the Noah's Ark exhibit and said, why don't you build Noah's Ark?
This is a tight-knit community where unemployment hovers near 11%. Marlene McComas has owned a flower shop on Main Street in Williamstown for 32 years. She's watched as other stores have closed and hopes the new jobs will bring new business to a dying town.
I stand over here and watch the people lined up at the Community Action Center every month to try and get help with their heat. Maybe that'll give those people a job so they can pay for their heat.
Still, the promise of jobs and a flood of tourists doesn't sit well with every resident or late-night TV comics like Jay Leno.
And Kentucky's governor says he has no problems giving state tax incentives to a Noah's Ark theme park. He says he's for this because it will create jobs. I'm not sure what jobs he's creating. I think we can rule out science teachers. Okay.
So, yeah, right there, huh? Probably something right there. Looking pretty good, huh? Y'all want to try it again?
Yeah.
Let's try it again.
At Grant County Middle School, Thomas Brackman volunteers at a science fair. He's a geologist at Northern Kentucky University and says the Creation Museum already poses problems for him as a teacher. His out-of-town family and friends are writing him now about this latest proposal.
And of course, it's about the Ark. And I have to write back saying, yes, and it's right down the road from us. This ought to bring, you know, notoriety to Northern Kentucky.
Editorial boards of Kentucky's two largest newspapers have railed against the project. So have academics who disagree with the creationist view of science. Ken Ham, the CEO of Answers in Genesis, says increasingly there's a bias against Christians who take the book of Genesis as literal history. He says the theme park's intent is to create more awareness of the Bible.
That's what it is. We make no apology about that. It is a theme park centered around biblical history.
What's getting more attention in Kentucky, though, is the proposed tax rebate. Under Kentucky's Tourism Act, the park could recoup over $37 million based on ticket sales and the money brought in over the course of 10 years. Erwin Chemerinsky is a constitutional scholar at the University of California, Irvine. He says building a Bible-based theme park isn't an issue, but giving it tax breaks violates the constitutional separation of church and state.
The Supreme Court has said that the government can't act with the purpose or effect of advancing religion. This project is all about advancing religion, even as the governor of Kentucky has described it. In that way, it violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Chemerinsky expects a legal challenge, but Governor Beshear remains confident.
People of Kentucky didn't elect me governor to debate religion. They elected me governor to create jobs, and that's what we're doing here, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
Developers hope to begin building the Ark this spring and to load up the animals two by two in 2014. For NPR News, I'm Sherry Lawson.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
The U.S. and other developed economies have lately been growing slowly, and that means most of the world's economic growth is now coming from developing nations. Investors are pouring money into emerging markets, pumping up their stock prices. A similar situation arose in the 1990s, followed by a crash. This time, governments in Southeast Asia are hoping to prevent the kind of economic meltdown that took place back then. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has the story from Bangkok.
Solapun Tunlaya Satien is a bit like a financial lifeguard. He monitors economic stability for the Thai finance ministry. In the past year, he's seen the tide of foreign capital surge in and out of Thailand, and luckily this time the economy was not washed away.
What's happening now is that a lot of the asset price, even the stock price, has not reached the 1997 level before the Asian crisis. So we are not reaching that the bubble stage yet, but we're seeing a lot of the fluctuation.
Last year, developed countries' governments borrowed or printed money to stimulate their economies. Hundreds of billions of dollars of it flooded into emerging markets in search of higher returns. Thailand got about $10 billion, which helped its currency, the baht, to appreciate by 9% last year and its stock markets to gain 41%. Paul Gambles, a managing partner with the Bangkok-based consultancy MBMG Group, reckons that in the past month or two, $1 billion of that so-called hot money has now exited Thai equities markets.
It's almost like, you know, capital on steroids. One day it's going crazy, and then the next day it's flowing back out again. The stimulus effect has worn off. Then we get another stimulus that drives it in, and it's waves and waves of capital inflows and outflows. And that's what markets really don't like.
More money is flowing into Southeast Asia because China is keeping the money out. China uses capital controls to do that. Fraser Howie, a Singapore-based analyst with CLSA, says that many observers fail to take China's capital controls into account.
They treat China as if it was any other country, but it simply is not. The capital controls are still relatively strict. There is a lot of slippage and a lot of leakage there. But ultimately, international investors are not easily able to get their money into China.
The U.S. and China are in, if not a currency war, then perhaps a currency fracas to keep their currencies devalued and their exports cheap. Solapun Tunlaya Satien says that the U.S. does this by printing more money, and China has done it by, until recently, pegging its currency to the dollar. And Thailand, Solapun laments, is stuck in the middle.
We cannot be against the market force. The U.S. is pumping out money. China is pegging. And we are standing in between the two giants.
Last year, Thailand and some of its neighbors began to try to deter hot money by using capital controls, such as taxing foreign earnings on the short-term bond market. Some economists abhor any form of government meddling in the economy, but CLSA's Fraser Howie says that governments in Asia now generally see capital controls as a legitimate economic tool of last resort.
The extreme cases or extreme events of recent years has allowed people to accept currency controls, but one shouldn't forget they are distorting, and they are leading to misallocation of capital.
Since the Asian financial crisis in 1997, Thailand and other hard-hit countries have recapitalized their banks and floated their currencies. Compared to Western countries, they have little government debt, plentiful foreign exchange reserves, and tight monetary policies. Paul Gamble says this ensures that capital will continue to flow to Southeast Asian emerging markets for the foreseeable future.
The next 10, 15, 20 years is when we see the assertion of emerging market, but primarily Asian dominance in the world as something that's absolutely inevitable. I don't think there's any policy anybody can do to stop this.
Asia's leading role in the global economy is hardly an anomaly, Gamble notes. It's a return to the status quo for most of the past 1,000 years. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Bangkok.
Several programs aimed at helping low-income Americans are among those facing budget cuts, including energy assistance for the poor. Brings to mind an earlier budget debate about 30 years ago when President Ronald Reagan came to office calling for steep cuts in government spending. But there was also a lot of talk then about preserving the social safety net, something that seems to be rarely mentioned today. NPR's Pam Fester looks at what's changed.
President Reagan promised a revolution, but when it came to trimming government spending, he said there were limits. And in his first address to Congress, he promised this.
The poverty-stricken, the disabled, the elderly, all those with true need can rest assured that the social safety net of programs they depend on are exempt from any cuts.
It turned out that wasn't completely true. The Reagan budget cut food stamps, welfare, and Medicaid.
But it's interesting that they felt politically they had to say that.
Robert Greenstein heads the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says the tone in the early 80s was much different than it is today. And he thinks one reason...
The Republicans in Congress now are well to the right of Republicans like Bob Dole or Howard Baker in the 80s.
Those were Senate leaders inclined to support government spending for the poor. In fact, Bob Dole was among the strongest congressional backers of food stamps. But today's Republicans, especially those elected in November, are primarily focused on reducing the size of government. Even President Obama has proposed cutting spending for the poor to help reduce the debt. And Greenstein says, what's more, the president rarely talks about what he has done to help low-income Americans, that the administration has clearly come to one conclusion.
That it's not good politics to talk about people at the bottom. The mantra is the middle class, the middle class, the middle class.
Social safety net, at the end of the day, is not that large a part of government.
Eugene Sterley worked on tax and budget issues in the Reagan Treasury Department and is now with the Urban Institute. He says one reason no one talks about preserving the social safety net today is that lawmakers have given themselves little choice but to cut it. They've taken taxes and entitlements such as Social Security and Medicare off the budget-cutting table, so there isn't much left.
Even if the Republicans say, well, we really don't want to hurt the social safety net, and Democrats say, we don't want to hurt it, we want to expand it, they've pushed our budget to a world where the social safety net is the target of opportunity.
He says that's a far cry from the early 80s, when despite the rhetoric, taxes were raised and entitlements trimmed to help bring the deficit under control. So last month, when House Republicans voted to cut $61 billion in spending, they included steep reductions in programs such as Head Start, community health centers, and nutrition for women, infants, and children.
There's a greater disposition to see the role of government reduced and less support for an activist government than there was back in 1981 when Ronald Reagan first took office.
Andrew Kohut of the Pew Research Center says the public then was worried that President Reagan would go too far reducing the size of government. Today, public attitudes are a lot different, except, he says,
when you raise specific programs, they say, I'm not so sure we want to see that cut.
Which is why those pushing budget cuts tend to talk about them in the broadest terms, as in the need to reduce the debt. Or what House Speaker John Boehner, in a speech last Sunday, said, even more broadly, was a moral issue.
The more the government spends and borrows today, the more our children are forced to pay. The damage is as much moral as it is fiscal.
And it's why anti-poverty groups, who think preserving the social safety net is also a moral issue, are furiously rounding up specific stories about the impact of such cuts in the hope they can stop them from going through. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Some promising news on the jobs front. The unemployment rate in the United States has fallen to 8.9%. The U.S. Labor Department released the new numbers yesterday and says that overall the country gained 192,000 jobs last month. Economists say that shows that job growth is finally gaining, and NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
One bright spot on the jobs report, manufacturing. It'd be easy to think that factory work is steadily disappearing in this country, but in fact, there have been steady job gains recently. Just last month, manufacturing created 33,000 new jobs.
Yeah, well, we just decided to hire on three new employees.
Patrick O'Connell is the vice president of operations for AccuRounds in Avon, Massachusetts. The company makes specialized metal parts.
And the receptionist was saying everything you make is round? I mean, is that
Yeah, everything we do is round, cylindrical parts. So shafts, bearings, pins, stuff like that.
The company makes metal posts for replacement teeth and dental crowns, parts for robots, tubes for making flu vaccine. Out on the floor, operator Joe Pelton is using a big computer-controlled machine to drill a tiny hole in a needle that's used to make microchips. A small river of oil is kept sloshing over the drill that's inside the machine.
So the hole can be...
What's the smallest hole we do?
The smallest hole is 4 thousandths.
Right. So we're doing 4 thousandths of an inch, which is smaller than a human hair in that hole. So can you imagine what kind of drill we have to use to go through there and the precision that it takes to make that? And we're making hundreds and hundreds of these.
And by looking at the orders that are coming in here, you can see what kinds of companies are doing more business again.
All right, semiconductor activity, or companies that are in the semiconductor sector. And we've seen a large increase in that activity over the last 3 months. It's very encouraging.
This latest jobs report actually showed pretty strong growth across most industries, which is encouraging to economists, too.
This is a really good set of numbers.
Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at IHS Global Insight. He says 192,000 new jobs is some pretty solid job growth. And he likes that the Labor Department revised the previous month's numbers upwards.
If you average the last 3 months' job growth, is close to 150,000. And that's starting to be pretty good. And now it seems to be picking up steam. And so finally, the recovery seems to be reaching the jobs market.
President Obama, it turns out, was pretty exuberant, too. Austin Goolsbee is the president's top economic advisor.
Well, you know, he was happy. I got a fist bump.
Goolsbee's been watching the unemployment rate fall sharply this winter, from up near 10 down to now below 9%.
This three-month drop from 9.8 is the biggest three-month drop in 27 years, and that's clearly the right way we want to be moving.
That is not to say that the unemployment problem is over. Companies are hiring, and at a pace that should continue to bring down unemployment, but slowly. Nariman Baravesh only expects it to fall to around 8% by the end of the year, and there are still 6 million Americans who've been out of work for more than 6 months. Back at the AccuRounds factory, computer-controlled machine operator Richard Rogers is one of the workers who's been hired in recent months. Before that, he was out of work for a long time.
I was out of work for 2 years, but I was in school for a year.
Rogers ended up going to a community college in another state, in Connecticut, to get the kind of training that he needed to get a job in a high-tech factory like this. Meanwhile, he was struggling to help put 2 kids through college, and being 60 years old, he says it was hard not to get pessimistic.
My biggest fear was finding somebody to hire me at my age. You know, I'm not a young man. It's tough, but I mean, it took me a while, but I mean, I got a good education and I just started applying.
But at least for now, there are still some 14 million unemployed Americans who are looking for work. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.